You ought to have counsel standing by, he advised. I'll have Rick and Phil there.
The reference was to Richard Benveniste and Philip Lacovara, two of Jaworski's assistants.
Haig asked what was cooking. There's no need for you to speculate, Jaworski replied, but you're going to need advice of counsel, so Jim St. Clair should be there. Haig, alarmed by Jaworski's tone and his uncharacteristic vagueness, called St. Clair. The president's lawyer couldn't figure out what it might be about either. Things seemed to be going well, St. Clair said. What the hell could be so important to drag him back to Washington on a weekend? He agreed reluctantly to come back from Boston for the meeting. That Sunday morning, Haig and St. Clair each made network television appearances as part of the White House public relations offensive. They emphasized the president's determination not to surrender any more tapes or documents. Haig, fashionable, in a muted plaid suit and a polka-dotted tie, said, I think the time has come for all of us to ask ourselves a pretty fundamental question. At what point in the review of wrongdoing does the review itself involve injustice, excesses, and distortions which, in effect, result in the cure being worse than the illness itself? Jaworski ordered a government car for the trip to the White House. Expecting a big black sedan, the prosecutor and his assistants were surprised when the driver showed up at the wheel of a small tan compact, which they barely squeezed into. At the south gate of the White House, Juwan met them and got in with some difficulty. They were taken to the diplomatic entrance of the mansion, where there was scarcely any chance of being seen by reporters. The four men piled out like clowns from a tiny circus car as Haig waited. Inside, the carpets were being cleaned and white throw rugs had been laid down every few feet. Juwan took Benveniste and Lacovara into the library, chatting along the way about the great personal sacrifices Haig had made by leaving the army to serve the president. As Juwan began telling war stories in the library, Haig escorted Jaworski to the map room. Jaworski was wearing a dark charcoal suit and looked very somber. They sat down on a high-backed sofa. Jaworski had prepared his speech carefully. He thought it would be appropriate to speak with unusual formality on this occasion. Alec, the grand jury in the last week of February authorized the special prosecutor to cite Richard Nixon as an unindicted co-conspirator in the Watergate cover-up. Haig sat silent as he tried to sort out his feelings. He was angry. What they had done was unfair. But he also realized that he had seen it coming. The president had feared that Cox would name him as a co-conspirator. It was Jaworski who had done it. About 15 members of my staff have known about this and have kept it quiet out of fairness to the president, the prosecutor said. Now you were forcing me to come out with it in a hearing, in response to the motion to quash. Jaworski paused. Haig kept his poker face. Where are we then? He asked finally. If the president is willing to give me 15 or maybe 18 of the tapes, we might be able to compromise, Jaworski said. That was the price. Haig felt trapped. It wasn't much of a bargain, no matter how he looked at it. He wanted time to think. St. Clair would have to be consulted, and Buzzard. Lacovara and Benveniste were called in. I've told Alec that the grand jury has taken this action, and that we are not eager to disclose this, Jaworski said. Alec thinks he was interrupted by St. Clair's arrival. The flight from Boston had been late. St. Clair shook hands and sat down. His gray pinstripe suit jacket was buttoned at the bottom, making him look even more portly. He seemed tired and drowsy. I've told Alec about a matter of some delicacy, Jaworski explained, and he handed St. Clair a copy of the grand jury transcript.
They were quiet as St. Clair thumbed quickly through the pages
in the confident manner of a man familiar with such materials. The others watched his eyes. When is this secret indictment going to be announced? He asked. A chorus of voices answered that the president was an unindicted co-conspirator. Haig was embarrassed. St. Clair attempted to gloss it over. He asked Jaworski whether he had anything else for him. Jaworski didn't reply. St. Clair's tone grew harsh. Jaworski, he implied, had chosen his moment because he had concluded that the president was surviving the impeachment investigation. Well, if Jaworski was hell-bent on forcing the information out, better now than later. This is an attempt to embarrass the president, he said.
We don't want to embarrass the president, Lacavara responded, and we don't want the judicial process to interfere with the impeachment process. The effect will be unfair to the president only if we cannot obtain an agreement consistent with our responsibilities to get materials relevant to subpoena.
I don't see how this is relevant, St. Clair protested.
It would seem relevant to Judge Sirica, Lacavara said. Sirica had to rule on the White House motion to quash the subpoena.
The grand jury thought the president had been involved in a crime. Therefore, this particular president could not legitimately exercise a claim of executive privilege. St. Clair took issue. The president continues to have the privilege unless and until he is displaced, Haig interrupted the debate.
It might be in our interest to consider this. Let's talk about it.
Chastised, St. Clair asked, what kind of compromise are you talking about? Jaworski was prepared to keep the grand jury's action secret in exchange for a reduced number of tapes.
This was blackmail, St. Clair said to himself.
But he also thought Jaworski wouldn't be able to make good on his promise. Somehow it would get out. He was sure of that.
Before I can decide, I need to know how many tapes and which ones you were talking about, he said. We'll have to discuss it with the president.
Jaworski was not surprised. He was aware that the lawyer had very limited authority. The meeting came to a perfunctory end.
Benveniste
was to inform St. Clair the next day which tapes they wanted. As they left the White House, Jaworski and his assistants were optimistic. Haig had seemed inclined to compromise, despite St. Clair's hostility. Actually, Haig thought he had been ambushed. He told St. Clair that Jaworski's proposal was a bad bargain no matter how it resolved. No bargain at all, really. He didn't want to have to make the decision either. He called Buzzard. It was a no-win proposition, Buzzard agreed. He thought they should refuse. There was no way they could be sure the secret wouldn't leak anyhow. Haig flew to Camp David that afternoon to tell the president. Nixon took the news passively, almost as if he had been expecting it. He would listen to the tapes Jaworski wanted. He, the president, would be the one who'd make the damage assessment, he said, purposefully. Haig had anticipated such a response. The president would make his decision based on what he heard. At about 6 o'clock that evening, Haig called Steve Bull and asked him to come to the president's EOB office and set up 2 tapes for Nixon. The president listened for several hours that Sunday night. Haig had some maneuvering to do. He was fighting 2 battles at once for control of the tapes. For the moment, Jaworski was disengaged as he awaited word on a compromise. A majority on the Judiciary Committee, however, agreed with Jaworski that the edited transcripts were an unacceptable form of evidence. But Haig continued to see hope in the 20-18 vote holding that the transcripts did not represent compliance with the subpoena. The initial vote to subpoena the tapes in early April had been 30-3. Haig consulted Timmons, St. Clair, and Ziegler. They all agreed that it was essential now to place the impeachment issue in as partisan a light as possible. The Republicans on the committee had to be held. The president's decision to resist the subpoena would need the support of other influential Republicans in the House, especially those who weren't regarded as down-the-line Nixon supporters. Barbara B. Conable Jr. of New York and John N. Erlenborn of Illinois were 2 such men. Conable's influence in the House, where he was the 4th-ranking Republican, was enormous. Nervous, vocal, intellectual, he was regarded by his colleagues as almost puritanical in his standards of personal and political conduct, a man of unquestioned integrity. Erlenborn, though a party man and a conservative, had a reputation for independence and was generally opposed to broad claims of executive privilege. He was highly regarded in the Illinois Republican delegation.
two of its members, Thomas F. Railsback and Robert McClory, were members of the Judiciary Committee. On Tuesday, May 7th, Haig and St. Clair had breakfast with Conable and Erlenborn in the White House mess. Haig set the tone. "The committee's position was extreme," he said. In addition to the tapes under subpoena, the committee had informally requested another 141 presidential recordings. Those would probably be subpoenaed, too. He complained about the length of time it would take to make transcripts of all the conversations. It could take 6 months, even more. It would be an ordeal. To meet the terms of the request would mean a delay that no one wanted, not the president, not the committee, not the House. The president wanted to cooperate. He wanted the impeachment process expedited. "The demands of the Judiciary Committee are unreasonable," St. Clair stressed. "What can we do not to appear to be obstructionist?" Conable was impressed. Haig and St. Clair were talking like reasonable men trying to deal with unreasonable men. He had an idea. "Now that the president has been forced to take off his clothes in public," the others chuckled, "the question of additional tapes can be handled like a game of Russian roulette. Tell the House committee that all the requested tapes won't be turned over, but that the committee can select at random 5 or 10 of the ones they want the most. Those tapes, not transcripts, will be turned over. It will be clear that the president has nothing to hide. It will also preserve the principle that the committee doesn't have unlimited access to the tapes." St. Clair said he was intrigued by the idea and promised to consider it. The meeting was going well. Neither Conable nor Erlenborn seemed in danger of deserting. The men finished their coffee, and on the way back to the Hill, the congressman praised St. Clair's skill and tact. For almost 2 years, Watergate had been a political nightmare for Hugh Scott, a politician accustomed to resting comfortably. Time and again, the White House had enlisted the minority leader's prestige in support of the president, only to undercut him with disclosures which Haig or Nixon had failed to warn him about. But Scott doubted that there had ever been so hellish a week as the one since the president had gone on television. As he watched Nixon that night, Scott had been relieved by the president's words and by the sight of all those stacked loose-leaf binders. But then he had read in the newspapers that the transcripts were scarcely vindicating, particularly the March 21st conversation that Haig had dangled in front of him in December. Consulting his copy of the Blue Book, Scott compared the March 21st transcript with his recollection of what Haig had shown him. They were substantially different. Large segments had been left out of the transcript he had seen in December. The reporters had begun pressing him to explain how he could reconcile what was in the transcripts with his public statements. Scott had called his staff together and expressed his chagrin. What was he going to say now? His staff was familiar with Scott's philosophy of leadership. "Don't move unless you have the troops," he often told them. Well, there weren't enough troops to justify a blast at the White House. It had taken the help of 3 aides before Scott had a one-sentence statement which did not, in any case, reflect his real opinion. "The statements I made in January seem, in my judgment, to be consistent with the full material I have read." Later, seething at what Haig had done to him, Scott had read about 2/3 of the 1,200 pages of transcripts. Now, Tuesday morning, May 7th, at the same hour Conable and Erlenborn were breakfasting at the White House with Haig and St. Clair, Scott took the elevator to his office and announced to his staff, "I have finished reading the transcripts. There is something I must do, now. I don't want anyone to try to talk me out of it. I simply have to do it." He rushed into his inner office and came out 20 minutes later with a statement which he read to some reporters who had been called by his press secretary. The edited transcripts, said the Senate minority leader, reflected a deplorable, disgusting, shabby, immoral performance by each of the participants. On the other side of the Capitol that morning, House Minority Leader John Rhodes was hunched over his desk, reading transcripts. He had finished about half of them and was dismayed. He was now persuaded that Richard Nixon was not indispensable as President of the United States. Aside from the amorality of Nixon's discussions, Rhodes thought they revealed a president who was not his own man, not in command. Rhodes had always thought Nixon was able. He had thought that the president's aloofness showed strength. He had always admired Nixon's ability to make tough decisions and stick by them. But no longer. "I have never read such sleaziness in all my life," he told an aide. At a press conference later that morning, a reporter told Rhodes what Senator Scott had said. "I won't quarrel with Scott's statement," Rhodes replied. At 2 o'clock, Scott walked through the Capitol to his weekly meeting with Rhodes in room H-230. They shook hands, more solemnly than usual. For months, there had been on-and-off discussions among the minority leaders, Barry Goldwater, and a few other influential Republicans, about the possibility of going to the White House to urge resignation. There might come a point, Rhodes and Scott had agreed, when they might have to jump ship for the sake of the country and the party and for themselves. It had always been regarded as a last resort, as hypothetical. Now the possibility seemed suddenly real. "Hugh, the time is coming when we may have to play the whole card," Rhodes said. Scott nodded. In the executive office building, many middle-level and junior presidential aides regularly stopped by the office of Mort Allen, who was in charge of compiling the president's daily news summary. There were wire service machines in the reception area, and the staff liked to drift through and see what was new. Today, Scott's and Rhodes's statements dominated both the news and the conversation in Allen's office. The GOP leadership's retreat was unprecedented and profoundly depressing, and other angry remarks from traditional Nixon supporters were coming over the ticker. Across West Executive Avenue, Haig flew into a rage when he was informed of Scott's statement. The disloyalty, the spinelessness of the man. Scott had not even warned the White House. Haig called him. "You've betrayed me," he shouted over the phone as if he were chewing out a corporal. Defensively, Scott said that his comments had not specified anybody in particular. Bullshit. Scott knew damn good and well whom the comments were directed at and what harm they would cause the president. The White House was trying to clear the matter up once and for all, and now this. The conversation ended abruptly. Scott was not Haig's major source of concern, however. The general had just received word from the president that there would be no more tapes for anybody. Period. He was not going to submit to Jaworski's blackmail. He was not going to feed the Judiciary Committee's insatiable demands. He had gone too far already. Haig understood the implications of the president's words all too clearly. He informed St. Clair. St. Clair phoned Jaworski. "The president does not wish to make any agreement," he announced. "His decision is final." Jaworski couldn't think of much to say. He kept thinking how St. Clair was stressing, overstressing, the fact that it was the president's decision, his decision alone. Jaworski politely acknowledged the call. The fact that the president would not negotiate further was the signal. There could be only one meaning. The tapes were incriminating. The president would rather risk disclosure of the grand jury's secret action than surrender the tapes. At 4 o'clock, St. Clair moved to inform the world in general and the House committee in particular of the president's decision. Dressing it in a cloak of presidential principle, the setting was Cocktails with Clausen, another of the presidential communications director's public relations innovations. Invited reporters were served glasses of soft drinks wrapped in napkins printed especially for these occasions, during which members of the administration made themselves available for interviews in an informal atmosphere. Sitting in a wing chair, his legs crossed and his hands extended, St. Clair said there would be no more tapes for anyone. The president had told the full story of Watergate in the transcripts he had already released. The only basis for further requests would be a desire by some to erode the presidency, and the president is not going to stand for it, St. Clair said defiantly. If others persisted, then we are going to have a confrontation, because the president is firm in his resolve that he has done more than is necessary. On Capitol Hill, Barbara Conable was indignant. What had become of the reasonable, conciliatory approach St. Clair had outlined at breakfast? There had been no suggestion of flat rejection. Conable now concluded that some way would have to be found to disassociate the Republican Party from Richard Nixon. On the House floor and in the cloakrooms late that Tuesday afternoon, Conable found a consensus that Nixon was a liability to the party. Some members were getting hysterical. Still, Conable decided to wait a few days. That afternoon, the president finished his listening. Cueing a tape from April 19, 1973, Steve Bull found a 19-minute gap in a conversation between the president and Ehrlichman. Aghast, he hurried to inform Buzzard.
"It doesn't surprise me," Buzzard responded casually.
Philip Buchan of Grand Rapids, Michigan, dined that evening at the Georgetown home of Clay T. Whitted, director of the White House Office of Telecommunications Policy. Buchan spent 3 days a week in Washington as executive director of the Federal Privacy Commission, headed by his former law partner, the Vice President of the United States. Whitted was baffled by Gerald Ford. Why isn't Ford doing something to organize himself? He knows that the Nixon administration is crippled. Is the Vice President prepared to take over?
"Far from it," Buchan said.
He had known Ford for years and was probably his closest friend. "Jerry can't do anything, because it would look like he was abandoning Nixon," he told Whitted. Ford was not the type of person to assert himself in such a delicate situation. And the vice president's staff was inept, Buchan said. They had done nothing to prepare for a Ford presidency. Buchan, however, had been giving the matter a great deal of thought. "I'm convinced that there is a real possibility that Nixon will resign or be impeached," he continued. And because neither Ford nor his staff could be relied on, someone had to begin planning immediately for a transition. He suggested they establish a small team. Whitted, a Harvard PhD who got his political education in the Nixon White House, had worked on the 1968 presidential transition. He was still an official of the Nixon administration, but his disaffection was almost complete. He had been an architect of the aggressive White House policy toward the television networks, a true believer. But for almost a year, he had operated as if there were no president. Twice, Haig had almost pleaded with him not to bring important matters before Nixon, citing the president's inability to act. "The president isn't in any shape to deal with this," Haig had told him once. Whitted looked forward to a Ford presidency. Perhaps the lost promise of the Nixon administration could be reclaimed there. He agreed to help prepare for a transfer of power. "Jerry can't know what's going on," Buchan stressed. "Absolute secrecy is necessary." They discussed who might join them. Buchan called it the Whitted Project. Whitted called it the Buchan Project. The next morning, May 8th, Scott received a call from George Bush, chairman of the Republican National Committee. Bush was having trouble keeping the party professionals in line. A move for Nixon's resignation was developing. "Things were getting worse on the Hill, too," Scott said.
"What in the world do we do now?" asked Bush. Scott said that he didn't know either.
Rhodes phoned next.
"At least 10 members have told me today that they are off the reservation."
The same thing was happening on the Senate side, Scott said.
Rhodes had talked with Goldwater about playing the whole card. Goldwater was ready to go along with whatever the minority leaders decided. The erosion of support for the president had been worse in the past few days than in the entire year before, said Rhodes. The White House response to the disaffection came that afternoon from the administration's resident Jesuit priest, Dr. John McLaughlin, a special assistant to the president. Meeting with reporters, Father McLaughlin advanced a theological analysis of the transcripts that attempted to prove that they were neither amoral nor immoral. Senator Scott's characterization, said the priest, was erroneous, unjust, and contains elements of hypocrisy, The president acquitted himself throughout these discussions with honor. Nixon spent most of the day by himself. At 6:30 p.m., he boarded the presidential yacht Sequoia for a trip down the Potomac. He sent his strip steak back to the galley because there was fat on it. The steward cut the fat off and returned the steak to the president, who sat alone at the dining table, gazing out at the shoreline. At a routine economic meeting with the Republican leadership at 8:30 the next morning, Nixon exchanged pleasantries with Senator Scott, who sat next to him. The minority leader's remarks about the transcripts were not mentioned. The president seemed even more bored than usual. He did not engage in any of his long monologues. After the meeting, George Bush told Barbara Conable that he was considering resigning as Republican National Chairman. Conable did not try to dissuade him. Haig approached Conable a moment later. "They're getting a little testy up on Capitol Hill, aren't they?" Haig said, a sarcastic grin on his face. "Yes," Conable answered, soberly. House Minority Leader Rhodes did not attend the leadership meeting at the White House. He was breakfasting with a group of reporters at the Sheraton Carlton Hotel, 3 blocks from the White House across Lafayette Park. He was grim and blunt. It might be a good idea for the president to consider resignation as an alternative to impeachment. If Nixon comes to conclude that he can no longer be effective as president, he will do something about it, Rhodes suggested. If he should resign, I would accept it. Resignation would probably be beneficial to the party. As Rhodes and his press assistant, J. Brian Smith, left the hotel by car, Smith said, "Your statement is going to make headlines." "I did it on purpose," Rhodes said, settling into the seat. "That's how I feel." A few moments later, he turned to Smith. "You can't imagine how miserable I feel when I can't support the president." House Republican Conference Chairman John B. Anderson of Illinois, the third-ranking House Republican, also held a press conference that morning. Anderson, gray-haired and urbane, a graduate of Harvard Law and a liberal, was hated by the Nixon administration. Convinced that the transcripts revealed a total moral collapse in the White House, he was equally disturbed at the reaction to them by most of his colleagues on the Hill, by the president's aides, and even by the press. There was no acceptable alternative to immediate resignation, Anderson asserted. The March 21st tape alone established a prima facie case for obstruction of justice. If the president did not resign, he faced certain impeachment. The first editions of that afternoon's newspapers played Rhodes's and Anderson's comments together. Though they had said somewhat different things, the distinction was lost, and their statements seemed to suggest a major move by influential Republicans to secure the president's resignation. Editorials in that day's Chicago Tribune, perhaps the staunchest Republican newspaper in the country, in the conservative Omaha World Herald, and in the Hearst newspapers, all called on the president to resign. William Randolph Hearst, Jr., editor-in-chief of the Hearst chain, and for years one of Nixon's strongest supporters, signed the editorial himself. At noon, Senate Majority Leader Mike Mansfield hurried to meet Senator Scott. They agreed that anything could happen now, and they decided that they should meet with Ford as soon as he returned from a speaking tour in Illinois. Even Ford seemed to step back from Nixon that afternoon. Speaking at Eastern Illinois University, he told the class of 1973, "While it may be easy to delete characterization from the printed page, we cannot delete characterization from people's minds with a wave of the hand. That is why I'm speaking frankly on the subject, perhaps more so than some of my colleagues might wish." At 1:08 p.m., Chairman Peter Rodino brought down the gavel to open the House Judiciary Committee's formal hearings on impeachment. The ceremony, following 7 months of staff investigation, was carried live on national television for 20 minutes. Then, after a brief debate, the committee voted 31-6 to close its doors for business. consideration of the evidence. Two thick binders were placed on each member's desk. Committee counsel John Doerr began reading from the first volume in a monotone that seemed to drive part of the committee to distraction and put the rest to sleep. St. Clair was permitted to remain to hear the evidence against his client. As he entered, he had told reporters, "The president will not be impeached. The House of Representatives will not impeach." Then, as he took his seat at the counsel's table in front of the two-tiered platform where the 38 members of the committee sat, St. Clair heard what sounded like 1,000 cameras clicking. He thought once again of the Army-McCarthy hearings. He was relieved that the hearings were beginning. At least he'd know where he'd be each day for the coming weeks, maybe months. The hearings might be a pro forma exercise, but being there was preferable to being at the beck and call of Haig and the president. St. Clair would get a call some mornings to come to the West Wing and would wind up spending 8 or 9 hours there, mostly waiting around. He would return to his desk in the EOB in the evening, exhausted from the frustration. He was tired of it all. On the few occasions when he had been permitted to see the president, Nixon had rambled on about nothing, often making little sense. After the Judiciary Committee adjourned that afternoon, reporters asked St. Clair for his reaction. "On balance," he said, "I'd rather be back in Boston practicing law." Anderson had a 4 o'clock appointment with Scott. They sat on one of the gold brocade couches in the minority leader's office. Anderson argued passionately that a delegation should be sent to the president to urge him to resign. "I do not favor that now," Scott replied. "Each person should make his own judgment. Certainly no collective action is timely now. The time will come, but it is not now. The troops still weren't there in sufficient numbers." Anderson thought that Scott lacked courage.
A light rain fell through most of the day. The president met a delegation of Vietnam War veterans, several favored congressmen, 5 departing staff members, and Bruce Hershenson, one of the anti-media writers on his staff, and Hershenson's parents. 2 people from Louisiana presented petitions of support to the president. Ziegler told reporters about the president's mood of determination. Deputy Press Secretary Gerald Warren elaborated, "Let me restate what I thought I made clear yesterday. The president has every intention to complete the work of his administration. He is determined to remain in office despite the discussions by some and attacks by others." Bebe Rebozo, who was testifying before the staff of the Senate Watergate Committee, described the president as in high spirits. "Nixon would never resign," Rebozo told reporters, "because he is confident he has done nothing wrong." White House Communications Director Clausen stated, "The president will not quit, even if hell freezes over, no matter what." All afternoon, Rhodes's office was swamped with phone calls objecting to the minority leader's remarks on resignation. Some of the callers threatened his life. An FBI agent was sent to his office to stand guard. That evening, at a party on Capitol Hill, Rhodes went through a receiving line in which the First Lady was standing. Approaching her, Rhodes summoned the brightest smile he could manage. "How are you, Mrs. Nixon?" he asked. A photographer asked them to pose for a picture. "Oh, yes," Mrs. Nixon said. "Let's smile, as if we liked each other." "Mrs. Nixon," Rhodes said, "it isn't the way you heard it."
"Yeah," she shot back. "That's what they all say."
Haig was finally convinced that the White House lacked a coherent strategy. Father McLaughlin, whom Haig detested, speaking about morality, and Ken Clausen talking about hell freezing over, weren't going to do the job. Timmons, Clausen, Buchanan, Gergen, and some of the lawyers had been urging for weeks that a strategy committee be established to coordinate the president's legal and public relations defense. Haig had another Gergen memo on his desk, organizing for impeachment. This time, Haig did not toss the advice into his wastepaper basket. Instead, he read, "It is time we faced up to the fact that this operational work is a full-time task. It can no longer be done with the left hand." Gergen was right. Haig decided. He summoned Dean Birch, the White House liaison to the Republican Party, to head the committee. They agreed that Buchanan, Timmons, Clausen, Gergen, Garment, and Buzzard should serve on it. Birch called the members to his office that Friday, May 10th. Their first task was to contend with the rumors that were sweeping the city, including one that the president's resignation was imminent. Nixon had met privately with Vice President Ford for 55 minutes that morning, contributing to the waves of speculation. Not all the rumors predicted resignation. One held that Nixon was going to issue a statement, another that he would call a news conference, a third that he would address the nation on television, a fourth said Nixon was turning over all the tapes under subpoena, another had the cabinet being assembled in an emergency session to hear the president, yet another had Secretary of State Kissinger flying back from the Middle East to accept the president's resignation letter. The Birch Group was bewildered. There seemed to be no solution other than to deny the rumors, and Jerry Warren had been doing that all day. The pressure became so intense that Ziegler finally called the New York Times with a statement. "The city of Washington is full of rumors. All that have been presented to me today are false. And the one that heads the list is the one that says President Nixon intends to resign. His attitude is one of determination that he will not be driven out of office by rumor, speculation, excessive charges, or hypocrisy. He is up for the battle. He intends to fight it, and he feels he has a personal and constitutional duty to do so." That evening, the president decided to take a ride on the Sequoia again. He left with his wife, David, and Julie shortly before 6. David had just finished an exam, and they were out to celebrate. It was a warm, pleasant evening. The breeze was refreshing. The four went topside and, sitting in the wicker chairs, sipped drinks. There had been another BB story in the papers that day. It said that Rebozo was under investigation for an unreported $50,000 political contribution he had collected in cash. Such stories almost always altered the president's mood and made him even more withdrawn than usual. Nothing seemed to sting the president as much as watching his friends being consumed by the scandal. As the yacht cruised downriver, a military aide approached the president. Photographers were waiting on the pier for the Sequoia to return, he said. More were lined up on the Potomac bridges in the hopes of getting a picture as the boat passed underneath. Nixon left his chair abruptly and started pacing. They were trying to get a picture of his face, goddammit. They were attempting to discover how he was handling the pressure. He picked up the ship-to-shore telephone. "Crown, get me Ziegler." Crown was the code name for the White House switchboard. The president was using an unsecure line. Anyone else listening could have heard only half of what was being said, however, because the send and receive ends of the conversation were on two different frequencies. Ziegler came on the line. "God damn it," Nixon shouted into the phone. Why was the press always hounding him? Why couldn't he get a few private moments? How had it leaked out that he was aboard the Sequoia? God damn it, he hadn't wanted it discovered. Why couldn't Ziegler control the press? God damn it! God damn it! Oh, God damn it! All week, David Eisenhower had noticed a strange, wavering quality in the president's voice. David was looking for signs of collapse in his father-in-law. He concluded, there was no way to calm Mr. Nixon with words. Quickly, he climbed up to the bridge to talk to Lieutenant Commander Andrew Coombs. Something had to be done. There was no way of knowing who would be waiting at the Navy Yard to witness the president's anger. They must outfox the press and dock elsewhere. There were only two alternatives, the skipper told David, to cruise to Mount Vernon and order a helicopter to take them back to the White House, or to dock at the old Anacostia Pier. But two Navy tugs were berthed at Anacostia, and it might be difficult to get them cleared out of the way. David went back to check with the president. He was talking quietly to the others now, and he seemed calmer. In just a few minutes, the fit of anger seemed to have subsided. David went topside again. He told Coombs that it would be all right to dock at the usual location. Half an hour later, the boat slid into its berth at the Navy Yard, and the president rushed into the waiting limousine before photographers could get a glimpse of him.
The days of May 1974 were lonely ones for Mrs. Nixon. There was an occasional reception or a tea, Military Wives of the Year, the Women's National Republican Club, a tea for visiting high school students from Ohio, the Senate Wives Luncheon, a breakfast for the wives of former members of Congress, saying hello to the veterans of foreign wars Poppy Girl. Almost invariably, Mrs. Nixon's appearances were short. She would arrive, shake a few hands, smile, allow a few photographs, and leave. The few times she lingered were when small children visited the White House. Then she would become animated, the joy in her face evident. Members of her staff marveled at how children always seemed to seek her out, even in a crowded room. Most of the First Lady's days were spent in her pale yellow bedroom on the second floor of the mansion. Her room, and the blue sitting room adjoining it, overlooked the South Grounds and offered a spectacular view of the Jefferson Memorial and beyond. A devoted letter writer, she spent hours on her correspondence, and she did a lot of reading, including the thin, inspirational volumes on friendship and love which rested on the night table next to her canopied bed. These were her rooms, and she had her privacy. Around 11 a.m., she would write out her lunch order, most often a chef's salad, soup, or a sandwich and coffee, to be served at 1 o'clock. More often than not, these days, the tray came back to the kitchen with the coffee gone and the food untouched. When she and the president dined alone, there was always a great rush to get the food from the kitchen to the table. Often, the Nixons had been seated for only a minute before the butlers started pressing to serve them. "Why the big rush?" a member of the kitchen staff had asked. "A minute is a long time when you're not talking," a butler had explained. On Camp David weekends, the president and his wife hardly saw each other. When they did, silence usually prevailed. Backstairs, their distance was an open secret. Marine Lieutenant Colonel Jack Brennan, the president's military aide, joked that his duties included briefing Nixon on how to kiss his wife. Mrs. Nixon always hated being a political wife. Since Nixon had come to Washington as a congressman, she had yearned to return permanently with her husband and children to California and live like an ordinary American family. She and her husband had not really been close since the early 1960s, the First Lady confided to one of her White House physicians. She had wanted to divorce him after his 1962 defeat in the California gubernatorial campaign. She tried, and failed, to win his promise not to seek office again. Her rejection of his advances since then had seemed to shut something off inside Nixon. But they had stuck it out. Watergate, and the tapes particularly, widened the gap. Despite the rein she kept on her emotions, the transcripts had visibly disturbed her. "How foolish to have tapes," she told her few friends and several chosen assistants. She would then smile or laugh nervously. "The tapes were like love letters," she said. "They should have been burned or destroyed." The White House physicians were worried about the First Lady. She had returned from a South American trip in April 1973, distraught and even more underweight than usual. She was becoming more and more reclusive and drinking heavily. On several occasions, members of the household staff came upon her in the pantry of the second-floor kitchen, where the liquor was kept in the early afternoon. Awkwardly, she had tried to hide her tumbler of bourbon on the rocks. Helen Smith, Mrs. Nixon's press secretary, tried to get the First Lady out to more parties and receptions. But wherever there was a gathering, there were reporters with Watergate questions. "Why bring it up?" Mrs. Nixon asked, dejectedly, when reporters caught up with her on a trip or one of the family's dinner outings to Washington restaurants. Smith had a tough job. Delicate and generous by nature, she had felt cruelly pushed around by Haldeman. Now Ziegler commanded her like a drill sergeant, oblivious to either her wishes or the First Lady's. He ignored Smith's memos and almost never asked her opinion on Mrs. Nixon's public appearances. The president himself insisted on picking the menus and the guest lists, and on supervising the seating arrangements for state dinners at the White House.
Ziegler and the president also concerned themselves with the slightest details of Mrs. Nixon's few public appearances. Mrs. Nixon's attitude towards such events was principally one of resistance. When Smith tried to schedule interviews or television appearances, the First Lady usually refused, saying, "Dick's too busy." Tricia Nixon Cox, called Dolly by her mother, also hated public appearances and avoided interviews scrupulously. So Julie Nixon Eisenhower, the younger daughter, became the family link to the outside world. In the days following release of the transcripts, Helen Smith was bombarded with requests for interviews with someone in the family. Julie and David agreed to meet reporters on Saturday, May 11th. It was a big event. Julie, wearing a polka dot blouse, and David in a Lacoste tennis shirt, stood before separate microphones in the East Garden. The noonday sun was brilliant. Question: do either of you foresee any point at which the president would resign? Absolutely not, no, David replied. He is stronger now than he ever has been in his determination to see this through, Julie added. The next question came from Robert Pierpoint of CBS. Mrs. Eisenhower, may I say first of all that I feel I have to apologize for addressing these questions to you, since in our system we do not hold the sins of the fathers against the following generations, and we don't have a monarchy in which you are going to inherit the power. I am not quite sure why you are here to answer these questions. Julie was visibly agitated. Mr. Pierpoint, I am going to try to control myself in answering the question because it really does wound me. I have seen what my father has gone through, and I am so proud of him that I would never be afraid to come out here and talk to any member of the press about resignation or anything else, even though it goes against my grain, because I know he does not want me out here because he does not want anyone to construe that I am trying to answer questions for him. Her voice was quivering. I am not trying to answer questions for him. I am just trying to pray for enough courage to meet his courage, really. Another questioner asked Julie how her mother was bearing up. She is able to take things with a grain of salt, Julie replied. She is philosophical, and I guess she finds she can hold up under all this because she loves my father and believes in him. As the interview neared its end, the president's daughter observed, "He is not shackled by Watergate. If you look at his appointment schedule, if you see the things he is doing, the people he is meeting with, it all confirms the message." The White House switchboard was flooded with calls praising Julie's performance. Later that afternoon, Smith encountered the president going up in the elevator and mentioned the response. He just stood there, silently. He does not look well, Smith thought. He does not look strong or vigorous. Nixon's face looked damp from sweat. She thought, this man is not in control of the situation. As she turned away, she saw tears in his eyes. Few of the president's men were as shocked by the transcripts as the senior academic intellectual members of the Nixon administration. Arthur F. Burns, the chairman of the Federal Reserve Board, Daniel Patrick Moynihan, ambassador to India and formerly an advisor on domestic policy, George P. Shultz, formerly the president's principal economic counselor. They read the transcripts in different parts of the world. They heard a Richard Nixon they had never been exposed to. Whatever Nixon's failings, these men had often been impressed by the president's strength, his competence, and the keenness of his mind. The Nixon of the transcripts was weak, insecure, indecisive, inarticulate, uncomprehending, even incompetent at times. The conspiratorial nature of the discussions surprised them less. In their minds, Watergate had always seemed characteristic of Nixonian excess. They knew the president could be petty, vicious, vindictive, unprincipled, particularly when he was with Haldeman and Ehrlichman. Heretofore, they could only guess at the hidden side of his personality. Now, as they read the thick blue volume with its deleted expletives and coarse, cynical language, candy ass, the hangout route, the guesswork was ended. There were basic elements of the Nixon character which the president could not bring himself to show them, they concluded. They were men he regarded as lofty thinkers, whose respect and approval he coveted and courted. Burns, the president's chief domestic aide and counselor during the first 2 years of his administration, was especially shocked. Nixon had spoken clearly, decisively, grammatically, and even eloquently to him. He had rarely sworn beyond a mild goddamn. The transcripts were full of presidential grunts, unfinished sentences, meandering thoughts which began almost nowhere and finished someplace else. Burns had never heard some of the expressions. He thought, here is a Dr. Jekyll, a split personality. What does it all mean? Does Nixon live a double life? Is he a great actor? Henry Kissinger was less amazed. He was in the Middle East when the transcripts were released. Copies of the Blue Books were forwarded to the secretary's plane. At night, in his hotel, and shuttling by air between capitals, he had time to read. He put aside the material that had been packed for him, a book on chess, some thrillers, and a pornographic novel, and turned to the transcripts with morbid fascination. Around Kissinger, Nixon was proud, even arrogant. Here, the president seemed full of self-loathing, oblivious to bullying and disrespect from his subordinates. Ehrlichman talked to the president like an exasperated parent addressing a stupid child. The language was baffling. Sure, the president occasionally referred to someone as an asshole after a few drinks, but never much more than that. In Kissinger's presence, Nixon was almost prudish, prissy even, the secretary thought. Nixon's greatest personal asset, Kissinger had thought, was his willingness to make big decisions himself, seeking consultation with only a few people, an ability to take big bites of a problem, as the secretary phrased it. But here, with Haldeman and Ehrlichman and the fanatics, it was all different. Watching the conspiracy unfold in the taped conversations confirmed what Kissinger had suspected. Of course, that's how it must have happened and evolved, he told his aides. This explains why Nixon refused to cut his ties with Haldeman and Ehrlichman even after their resignations. The transcripts would be Nixon's undoing. Even if he clung to office, how would he govern after this? All moral authority was gone, Kissinger said. The deletions and denigrating characterizations suggested something else, long concealed, about the Nixon character. Rumors and some reliable reports circulated that Nixon regularly employed ethnic slurs, particularly anti-Semitic ones, and that some had been deleted from the transcripts. Was Nixon a racist? An anti-Semite? For his part, Kissinger was convinced that the president was anti-Semitic. He had believed it for years. As the son of German Jews who had fled the Nazis, he was particularly sensitive to what he regarded in Nixon as a dangerous brand of anti-Jewish prejudice born of ignorance. He saw in the president an antagonistic gut reaction which stereotyped Jews and convinced Nixon that they were his enemies. Many times Kissinger returned from a meeting with Nixon and told his deputy, Lawrence Eagleburger, "That man is an anti-Semite." The remark by Nixon, which most often unsettled Kissinger, was well known to the president's close associates. "The Jewish cabal is out to get me." The meaning of the often repeated comment was a source of debate within the administration. Many believed that it reflected hostility more to intellectuals than to Jews. Late in 1971, Nixon had summoned the White House personnel chief, Fred Malik, to his office to discuss a Jewish cabal in the Bureau of Labor Statistics. The cabal, Nixon said, was tilting economic figures to make his administration look bad. How many Jews were there in the Bureau, he wanted to know. Malik reported back on the number and told the president that the Bureau's methods of weighing statistics were normal procedure that had been in use for years. Later, there was another suspected Jewish cabal in another department. Malik, a young West Point and Harvard Business School graduate who had been brought into the administration by Haldeman, knew that these tirades were not reserved for Jews. The president had once told him he did not want any more fucking academics or goddamn Ivy Leaguers appointed to high positions. They were wrecking his programs.
Most, if not all, of the problems in government could be traced to them. Haldeman had directed Malik to ignore presidential orders, which suggested departmental purges or quotas. And Nixon did, in fact, continue to approve appointments of academics, even Ivy League ones, and Jews. Arthur Burns, himself a Jew, was convinced that Nixon was not truly anti-Semitic. There were, however, ugly strands of prejudice in the man. Burns had concluded, and he was not surprised that there were apparently anti-Semitic remarks on the tapes. The president really didn't have much love for humanity, Burns believed. Why should Nixon love Jews any more than Japanese or Italians or Catholics? Nixon regularly employed epithets for whole sections of mankind, he knew. Burns and Kissinger had often discussed the question. Burns used to point out that the president greatly admired Israel and that a large number of Jews served in his administration. What disturbed Burns was something he considered apart from anti-Semitism. If the president perceived that Jews or Israel or anyone else for that matter got in his way, he was prepared to stomp them. Burns vividly recalled a 1973 White House meeting during which the president had a tantrum about an amendment to his trade bill. The amendment would have restricted business with the Soviet Union if Russia did not ease its persecution of Jews. Members of the Jewish community were causing him difficulties, Nixon said, because of their support for the amendment. A wave of anti-Semitism might descend on American Jews if they persisted, he predicted. Burns watched Nixon very closely on that occasion, and he was impressed by the president's fury. Burns felt that Nixon was saying that Jews might suffer for thwarting his will. After a year of dealing with Nixon, Fred Buzhardt had learned to discount the president's diatribes. Nixon said vile things about everybody. About bureaucrats, congressmen, reporters, lawyers, Russians, Democrats, Easterners, ethnic groups, his own staff. Just after David and Julie's press conference that Saturday, Fred Graham, a CBS television reporter, called the White House press office for comment on a story scheduled for that evening's news. Graham had information that in two of the tapes, the president had made disparaging remarks about Jews and had called Judge Sirica a WOP. When he was asked by Ziegler, Buzhardt insisted to the press secretary that he had heard no such thing on the tapes. Ziegler tried, but couldn't talk Graham out of the story, so he moved to kill it. He told two of his secretaries to get hold of CBS correspondent Dan Rather. Failing that, they were to reach Walter Cronkite, or the CBS Washington bureau chief, or the producer of the CBS Evening News, or the president of CBS, Arthur Taylor. None could be reached. Ziegler blamed the secretaries and started shouting at them when the story went on the air. "Ron, we can only place the calls," responded Ann Greer. "If you think you can do any better, then be my guest." The next morning, a similar story by Seymour M. Hersh ran in the Saturday New York Times. Hersh cited conversations between Nixon and Dean on February 28th and March 20th, 1973. Both the White House and James Doyle, chief press officer for Special Prosecutor Jaworski, had tried to call Hersh off the story. Doyle had checked transcripts of the two conversations Hersh referred to, and he couldn't find the references. The problem, it was later discovered in the White House, had been caused by transcription errors. One of the original transcripts ascribed the phrase "Jewish boy" to the president. A corrected version put it in Dean's mouth. And an initial and therefore uncorrected version of the other transcript in question indeed had the president calling Judge Sirica a goddamn WOP. But Nixon's actual words, which sounded similar on the scratchy recording, had been, "That's the kind I want," a reference to a tough judge like Sirica. There were ethnic references on the same tapes, including some that might be regarded as anti-Semitic. But Buzhardt knew they were not the remarks cited in Hersh's account. The president had, in fact, said on one tape that it was not going to be his policy to have a Jewish seat on the Supreme Court, as it had been for some other presidents. Jews, he said, were intelligent and aggressive and were everywhere in the government. If any minority group needed a leg up, it was clearly not the Jews. Nixon had then praised his liberal foe on the court,
Justice William O. Douglas, and had made disparaging comments about his own appointees. Now Haig, Ziegler, and Buzzard felt they finally had an opportunity to strike back at the opposition. The president had been unfairly accused. On Sunday morning, Buzzard appeared on an interview show to denounce the news accounts. "There have been fabrications," he said. "There have been attempts to portray remarks that are on the tapes as racial slurs, and they are not. And I wonder, you know, it's clear that a concerted campaign has been made to cause these to be publicized." He clasped his fingers together to denote the interlocking nature of the conspiracy. "And that is one of the problems. It bothers many of us. Obviously, this type of material is not relevant to the question of whether the president has committed treason, bribery, or high crimes or misdemeanors. I can only characterize this as malicious and vicious attempts to poison the public mind against the president by any means." On Monday morning, at the Birch Group meeting, Buzzard argued forcefully for some counter-move to the stories. Garment, a Jew, agreed to listen to the relevant tapes and then, if justified, go out on the White House lawn to refute the Times and CBS accounts in front of cameras.